Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we're coming to you once again from right smack dab in the middle of Moscow. I think a lot of people would refer to this as the Kremlin area, and it is, in fact, the Kremlin area, with the buildings that you see behind me are part of the historic Kremlin-walled city, an ancient city where all the important buildings used to be, and frankly, where most of the important churches and where the important buildings still are. Although today people refer to this as the Kremlin, they're talking about the general area. You can see there, as a matter of fact, if you could, Gene, let's show the general semblance of what a typical day in Moscow is in the summer. As you're going to probably see, most of the people are out and about. Some of these people are coming, as often this place is kind of a magnet for families and for people all over Russia, where they come to kind of pay homage to their own culture and to their own history. This is a particular interesting time for the people of Russia, obviously because of the war with Ukraine, which is front and center in the minds of many people. But also because of the effect that it's having on Russia itself. Most people would have expected that this war would be fought on the front, right? Right there between the Ukrainian soldiers and the Russian soldiers, which it is. But much of the war now is being fought actually in parts of Russia as well, as Russians experience many of these drone attacks, which we have seen, which brings into question many of the things that we're going to be discussing today. Because one of the reasons we're here today is because we want to do a deep dive on what is the moral imperative of this war from a civilian standpoint. What is the impact on civilians? What are civilians in Ukraine, by the way? What are Ukrainian civilians feeling? What are Russian civilians feeling? And what is being done to compensate for the needs of both Russians and Ukrainians? You know, it's interesting. I say that, and a lot of people are probably listening to me and saying, well, wait a minute, but you're in Moscow. How can you be talking about Ukraine? Most Russians see Ukrainians as one people. Different countries, yes, but one people. And that goes to the history of how this land was formed, which is why there's an effort underway now to talk specifically about the human rights of the Russian and the Ukrainian people. And we're going to be talking with someone who is a superstar of her own right when it comes to that. But let me just catch you up a little bit first, if we can, on some of the headlines. I spoke a little while ago about what's happening right now on the front lines. And there is some important information that I want to share with you just to get you through it, because that's where this war will actually be won or lost. And the place where this is taking place right now is a place called Kramatorsk. I think we've got a map that I can show you about what's happening there. I had told you before that there is, by most military experts, it looks like the Russian military has basically started to break through in the Donbass, but there are some cities that still need to be taken or liberated, as the Russians would use in their phraseology. And one of the key cities is a place called Kramatorsk. And Kramatorsk is now, according to my sources, about 5 kilometers from being not taken, but from the Russian military actually being in Kramatorsk. In other words, reaching the edge of Kramatorsk. By the way, for those of you watching us in places where you don't understand what kilometers are, that's about 3 miles. And that usually is pretty much nothing. That means the Russian military is knocking on the door of Kramatorsk, and that would obviously be really important. But let me underscore again, that doesn't mean that they're going to be taking the city by tomorrow or the next day. It usually would take at least a couple of weeks for the troops to be in Kramatorsk, and then possibly another month before they can say they have, quote, liberated Kramatorsk. But this is really important and something I want you to watch out for, because it could hasten what could be a ceasefire between the Russians and the Ukrainians. The other big story that we're following on this day is taking place on the Red Sea, and this is huge. It appears that the Houthis, who, as you know, are in line with the Iranians, have hit 2 Saudi Arabian tankers. Now, this is perilous, because we know what the problem is right now on the Strait of Hormuz. This would also affect the Strait of Al-Mandab. And if the Strait of Al-Mandab, as we've mentioned, is closed along with the Strait of Hormuz, that means something like 35% of the world's resources are not going to be able to get through. And we're talking about hydrocarbons and almost every other piece of equipment or cargo that affects the world's economy. So this is something we're going to be watching very closely. By the way, Mr. Trump
has reacted a while ago. Mr. Trump says, this is deplorable. I'm going to hold the Houthis. They will be held responsible. So obviously, this looks like something which is going to be escalatory. This looks like something which will escalate this war to new measures. Already we're seeing that so far in most of the first signs of it, which is the price of oil, which is obviously the Brent, has shot up just within the last little while. All right, so what I'd like to do now is start talking about what is the most important story in all of Russia, and that is the people of Russia, as well as the people of Ukraine, and how they are being affected by this war. And to do that, I want to bring in now somebody who is a superstar, and I mean that in her own right, Yana Lantratova. She is the High Commissioner of Human Rights in Russia. And she has really hit the scene recently, and she's become extremely visible. You see her now all over Russia talking about human rights, which is extremely important. And welcome. It's so nice to have you here.
Здравствуйте.
Good to see you, Madam Commissioner.
Очень рада видеть вас.
Спасибо. Very, very happy to be here. Thank you.
You know, a lot of people don't know this, and you can do a Google search yourself, but a lot of people wonder, and you always hear, one of the things for me as a journalist covering Russia is that people always tell me, oh, you're in Russia. That's a dangerous place. It's a very authoritative place. It's a very, it's an autocratic state, and Putin tells everyone what to do. In actuality, if you look at the breakdown of how the Russian government is created, it's very similar to what we have in the United States. You know, we have in our Constitution what's called the Inalienable Rights Clause, right? Well, Russia also has in its Constitution the basic human rights and the basic freedoms of all Russian individuals shall be guaranteed. They are inalienable rights, I'm quoting, and they are to be enjoyed from birth from all people in Russia, whether they are citizens or not. That I just read you is from the Russian Constitution. And it's something they take quite seriously here. And you, Madam Commissioner, are responsible for it. So once again, thank you for joining us.
Спасибо большое.
Let's start talking about some of the incidents that we have seen lately, and that is the drone attacks. You and I were together in Starobelsk, right, in Luhansk. And what we saw there was horrible. It was essentially missiles that had hit a college where students were killed. You knew some of these students. Is that the act that has moved you to take this new task of yours so and treat it with so much import?
For me, the topic of Starobelsk has become personal because Donbass has been a part of my heart since 2014. You mentioned the city of Kramatorsk, and in 2014, when I was a civil activist and human rights defender, I received a phone call from a woman from Kramatorsk. She was crying and saying that the city was under blockade. There was no electricity. There were shellings and looting, and children were hiding in basements. She told me, "I'm asking you to do whatever you can. Just evacuate them from the combat zone." Yeah. The first city I went to as a mother, human rights defender, and volunteer was Gulovka. Whenever the shelling would stop, even briefly, my team and I would rush into the basements where children were hiding. And I saw with my own eyes what was happening there. I saw horrifying things, including the bodies of people who had been killed. I saw teachers who, despite the terrible shelling and the emergency situation, continued to teach children. They worked with them, and the children stayed there. Of course, at that time, as a mother, human rights defender, and volunteer, my main priority was to save those children. The first thing we started organizing was buses to evacuate children from the area of the shelling. The children would run onto the buses and lie down on the floor. We would cover their heads with our hands and change the route to get them out of the danger zone. This was because buses were being attacked and overturned while shots were fired at the children as they left. At that moment, the only thing that mattered to me was doing everything possible to save those children. That was when we wrote our first letter to then-President Petro Poroshenko, asking him to establish a humanitarian corridor.
Can you have human rights under war or warlike conditions? That's a tough question, isn't it? Think about that for a minute. I mean, I understand sometimes wars are inevitable because bad people do bad things. But
when we hear people talk about human rights, when bombs are going in either direction, how do you protect the human rights of average citizens in a war? That's a tough task.
It is necessary. This is likely the moment when protecting these people is most crucial. You mentioned Starobelsk. I will show some photos. I personally knew many of these children and had seen them before. It was a college where the children were sleeping, young people aged 14 to 19. There were three drone strikes, spaced 10 to 15 minutes apart. The children would run out and they would be struck. They would run out and be struck again. We spoke with the rescue workers and they told us that the rescue operation lasted 45 hours. It was halted 18 times due to additional strikes. And you may recall that in Starobelsk, many visiting journalists wanted to see if there was actually a base there, a military base, like the one so widely reported in foreign media.
I was there and I asked the question, and by the way, Madam Commissioner, I saw you, and then I took it upon myself to go into the village and I asked all the citizens who lived in and around Starobelsk, and I said, have you ever seen Russian soldiers here? Have you ever seen Russians firing missiles from here? And to a person, every single one of them, we could play the video for you, every single one of them said, absolutely not. This is college and this has always been a college. So I can confirm that you're absolutely right.
It's always been there. It's always been there in history. This was always a branch of the pedagogical college where the children studied. And we saw these notes the kids wrote. They were preparing to be educators, preparing to be teachers. You know, it's probably unique in history, in their mentality. And it just so happened historically that words are very important to us. And so we're now talking about various international humanitarian norms and rules. I took the Security Council resolutions, which were co-sponsored by Ukraine, Greece, Great Britain, and other countries. What do these norms say? First, the educational process cannot be stopped. Teachers cannot be shot at or killed. What do we see? Starobelsk, Energodar, Volnovakha, Yasinovatia, schools, colleges, universities. Second, it says civilians cannot be killed. Over this period, more than 12,000 civilians have died in Donbass. More than 40,000 civilians have been wounded. These are the facts we have documented and know about. What is happening now, every day? Today, a child died.
Do we have a breakdown of those 12,000 civilians? By the way, when I Google it, I get 13,000, 14,000, whatever. It's too many, but the number is what it is. How many of those are the Ukrainians responsible for, and how many of those is the Russian army responsible for? Do we know?
We see that all these civilians died in attacks. At first, when military action began in Donbass in 2014, they fired rockets, and we saw the remains of those rockets. And now it's drone strikes, and these strikes continue every day. Look, a child died today. Today they attack playgrounds and hit buses. For example, in the Bryansk region, there were children from Belarus traveling to Gelenjik for vacation. A drone struck the bus, killing the children. And so it goes every day.
Yes.
Moreover, I often hear about a place in the Kherson region called Oleshki. Representatives of the Red Cross came and they talked about Oleshki. Every day, the Ukrainian side mines the road with drones. Drones arrive and mine the road, and ambulances arrive. It's also written into international law that doctors cannot be targeted. More than 19 ambulances have already been destroyed in this area alone. That is, people are being blocked there, civilians, some of whom have relatives in Ukraine and some in Russia. That is, civilians being attacked every day and we see them dying. You saw the wreckage of foreign-made drones in Starobelsk, which were paid for by foreign taxpayers. So the deaths of these children in Starobelsk, whom we show, are essentially happening because that money is being used to buy drones.
I understand. And so here's the real question, I think. The question is, we need to find a way. This is your task. We need to find a way, Madam Commissioner, to separate what is an attack, deliberate attack on a civilian, as opposed to a attack on a military target where perhaps civilians may have been injured or killed. And
this is the crux of the problem. It's hard to do that because, for example, as you mentioned, the Ukrainians say that the college where the students or the kids were killed, they say that was actually a military base and those students were actually cadets. Whether it's Russia who accidentally kills Ukrainians or Ukrainians who kill Russians, in the end, do we need, does the world, not just Russia and Ukraine, need a better way to be able to delineate the difference between killing civilians and accidentally killing civilians? I mean, deliberately killing civilians as opposed to accidentally killing civilians?
During the Easter period, our president, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin, said, let there be a ceasefire. Let us not shoot at people so this good Christian holiday can be observed peacefully. What happened? We fulfilled our commitments, but the other side did not. Attacks continued and people died during those days. And unfortunately, this happens every time. This is a very serious problem. And do you know what is the source of the problem? It is quite shocking. I read statements by representatives of Ukraine and various political figures who say that people in Donbass are genetic waste. They call them genetic waste, which suggests that in their view there are people in one category who have the right to live and enjoy human rights, and there are those in a second category, the people of Donbass who can be killed and the children of Donbass who can be shot at. Look, since 2014 I have been evacuating these children. I asked for humanitarian corridors to be established. In fact, I was ready to take a girl out at night after a shell hit her eye, and we needed to save her from going blind. She simply needed to be evacuated from there. People were dying there every day. As a human rights defender, mother, and volunteer, I asked for humanitarian corridors in accordance with the conventions that Ukraine had joined, so children could be taken out of the combat zone. But for them, that would have meant admitting that they were shelling Donbass. Instead, I was not allowed to go there. Criminal cases were opened against me, four criminal cases. I was labeled a terrorist and included on execution lists, all in order to prevent me from getting children out and saving them. It is very important that when we save children, Russia provides them with medical treatment and rehabilitation. We have always known this, but there are no such actions by the other side.
Do you get a sense that the world, and when I say the world, let me be more specific, and let me say, do you get a sense that the West, the United States, the media in the United States, my country, the UK, Paris, the Germans, etc., view Russian lives or care less about Russian lives or the lives of Russian civilians than they do the lives of others, for example? That there's a double standard? For example, we do see every day drones are hitting Russia, and I don't see headlines about that in Western papers, but whenever a Ukrainian...
They do not want to acknowledge this because in their view there are people of the first and second categories, some who have the right to live and others who do not. The Office of the Human Rights Commissioner regularly sends letters regarding every documented case to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and to all international organizations, asking them to provide an honest and fair international assessment of these war crimes. There is no other way to describe them. They can only be called war crimes. It is very frightening. I saw with my own eyes, together with our entire team of volunteers, what was happening there. I saw how people were used as human shields. Civilians were placed up front. Children were put forward as shields. I saw what Ukrainian and neo-Nazi groups were doing. They would take small children from their homes to pass through Russian checkpoints and then abandon those children afterwards. I will never forget those baby strollers with infants inside, which were simply used as a kind of shield to get through. All of this happened. Moreover, the Office of the Human Rights Commissioner collects evidence of all crimes. In our office, we have a brand iron that was brought by staff members from the Kursk region, a border area of the Russian Federation. They say that Ukrainian neo-Nazis branded Russian civilians there and that soldiers used this mark to burn symbols onto people. They compare this to practices during the Great Patriotic War when Nazi soldiers branded Soviet prisoners. This is a practice associated with fascism. We also have shackles that were brought from a library in Mariupol. I asked, why a library?
Really?
Because civilians were allegedly held there in shackles. Priests and women were among those detained, and drills were allegedly used to drill into people's legs. Many eyewitnesses have spoken about this, and we have documented the names of these people. We have seen these individuals with these marks. Just look at what is happening. This is a violation of all rules. It is not only military personnel who suffer, civilians suffer as well. This is a violation of the norms of international humanitarian law.
A lot of our audience, you know, we have millions of people who are watching us right now from around the world, and a lot of the people who are watching us are in, you know, Western countries, and they probably don't know, and maybe you can explain to them, that what we're talking about are not just things that have happened since 2022 or 2023. These are things that go way back. In other words, the people who live in the Donbass view themselves, correct me if I'm wrong, ethnically as Russians. They go to Russian churches, they speak the Russian language. They wanted to live in Ukraine, but they wanted to remain ethnically Russian. And the new government of Ukraine, as I understand it, went in there and started punishing them for wanting to be Russian. And that's why Mr. Lavrov talks about this all the time. That's the genesis of why the Russians went in to protect the people of the Donbass. Is that correct? It did start back then? Are there documented cases of human rights abuses of the people prior to 2022?
That is exactly what happened. Moreover, I can speak about this as a witness to these events. We were there, and I saw it with my own eyes. People were detained simply for speaking Russian or singing songs. By the way, this is still happening on the territory of Ukraine. Recently, I saw a report about people being detained for singing the Russian song Katyusha. There is also a foundation called White Angels, which currently evacuates civilians in Ukrainian-controlled territory. They approached an elderly woman and asked her if she needed to be evacuated. She replied that she had relatives in Russia. They told her, then you will be put on the exchange list. They are allegedly taking civilians prisoner, treating them like prisoners of war in order to exchange them. In this case, her crime was simply having relatives living in Russia. You understand what kind of standards and practices these are. The same thing happened back in 2014 when shells began hitting schools and hospitals when civilians were being killed, wiped out. You know, there was this girl Vika, a shell fragment hit her eye. There was also a girl named Diana. She was 7 years old and was traveling in a car with her mother, father, grandmother, and brother. The Ukrainian armed forces allegedly opened fire on this car. Everyone was killed, and she was left among the bodies of her family members. When she was handed over to us to be saved, I held her in my arms. She fell asleep, then woke up and started talking to her deceased parents. It was terrible. I saw with my own eyes what was happening to people. They were not allowed to speak Russian. They were not allowed to identify themselves as who they wanted to be. This is how, in my view, the genocide of the people of Donbass began. And this was before 2022.
I'm wondering, you are in charge of human rights. Human rights are not just the human rights of Russians, obviously. You happen to be a Russian and this is your task. And you seem to be doing it magnificently because people all over Russia are talking about you and about your work. Congratulations to you. But you, as a human rights commissioner, are responsible for the human rights of all citizens, whether they're Palestinians or Israelis or Ukrainians or Russians or Americans or no matter where they are. How much of the effort, because I know as a Russian, you care about Ukrainians too, right? Would you work just as hard to defend the rights of a Ukrainian whose human rights have been abused as you would the rights of a Russian?
The Office of the Human Rights Commissioner already has more than 50 international agreements on cooperation with foreign ombudsmen and human rights organizations. If a situation arises, whether one of our citizens abroad finds himself in a difficult situation or another person faces problems here, we immediately contact the relevant ombudsman, communicate with him or her, visit the person, and provide the necessary assistance. Moreover, there are various ombudsman alliances, including the Eurasian Ombudsman Alliance. On November 17, an international scientific and practical conference will be held here in Moscow, with representatives from 64 countries attending. We will discuss human rights protection practices around the world, exchange experience, and share best practices. And you are right, we protect absolutely everyone, regardless of who a person is. For example, in Russia, if a person has relatives in Ukraine, he or she can freely leave and travel there. We do not prevent people from doing so. However, people are not always able to come here. Recently, for example, the son of a woman came to our office. His mother had traveled to Kiev to take care of his sick mother. She managed to evacuate her, but then she herself became unable to leave. She began having heart problems, had no money, could not find work, and eventually suffered a stroke. Her son asked us to help bring his mother back, but she cannot be evacuated unless she's included in an exchange process. Civilians are also being exchanged. And this is exactly what you said. Human rights defenders are like doctors. They must help any person who finds themselves in trouble, regardless of who they are. There is a Ukrainian ombudsman, Dmitry Lubinets, and we have established very effective communication with him. What have we agreed on? First, we meet with him on the territory of Belarus. Our Belarusian colleagues provide us with this opportunity. We also regularly communicate through video calls or by telephone. If people come to us and say that someone has gone missing, we do not know whether the person has died, is being held captive, or is alive, but in a hospital. We exchange lists and quickly check whether this person is located on the territory of our respective countries. Second, we provide each other with information. We also mutually visit prisoners of war and monitor the conditions in which they are being held. When we meet on Belarusian territory and buses arrive, the Office of the Human Rights Commissioner, together with the Ministry of Defense and relevant security agencies, participates in the prisoner exchange process. During the period that I have held this position, we have managed to return 550 Russian prisoners of war home and transfer 550 Ukrainian prisoners of war back to Ukraine. We enter the buses together with the ombudsman, speak with the prisoners, take care of them, and provide support. We also exchange parcels and letters from relatives and loved ones, which we deliver to those being held in captivity. It is important to understand that there are currently no diplomatic relations between the two countries and no official ties. But as Ukraine correctly said, there is a shared history. We were once part of the same country, the Soviet Union. For example, a soldier may have died, and his parents may have previously lived on the territory of Ukraine or Russia and have already passed away. We need official documents and certificates so that compensation payments can be made and pension issues can be resolved. Our communication now allows us to exchange these documents and certificates, create humanitarian channels, protect people's rights, and help reunite families. This is especially important because civilians from the Kursk region were illegally held on Ukrainian territory after being captured during the incursion into the Kursk region. People were allegedly shot, killed, and civilians without weapons were taken prisoner. Through negotiations, we managed to return all civilian residents of Kursk back to our country. This is an important humanitarian channel.
Here's an interesting question for you that I'm thinking about as I'm listening to you. Given the fact that I now know that more Ukrainian refugees / immigrants have come to Russia than any other country, 5 million to 6 million people who used to be Ukrainian are now living in Russia since the war began. Another million are in Germany, another almost million are in Poland, and they're scattered. But the biggest number is in Russia. So Ukrainians like Russia and want to live in Russia even since this war broke out. So here's my question. How many people, or do you know of cases where soldiers who were captured by the Russian military were brought to Russia and then have said, I don't want to go back to Ukraine, I want to stay in Russia? Does that happen?
4 days ago, I spoke with Ukrainian prisoners of war who told me, I do not want to go back there. My wife is in Crimea. My wife is in Bryansk. My mother is in Lugansk. I do not want to return there. And such cases exist. Many of the soldiers who ended up in captivity told me, we did not want to fight. We do not want to fight. We were forced into it. And why? I asked them how they ended up in captivity, and they said they had been forced to fight. You know, you can watch Ukrainian programs as well, and even the servicemen themselves say that there is violence, that there is pressure, that they are being forced to fight. They do not want to fight. Mm-hmm. I will tell you something remarkable. Yeah. I was traveling on a bus with Ukrainian soldiers, and I asked, who wants to go home? You will soon be home. Take the phone. We let them make calls. One soldier's mother answered, another's wife, another's child. I heard a child's voice saying, Daddy, I love you. The wife asked, are you really going to let him come home? I said, yes, the Russian side is returning your loved ones home. Soon they will be back. Tell your child not to worry. Daddy will be home soon. And the wife said in Russian, I just want this war to end as soon as possible. People are suffering. The most painful thing is that people are dying. Civilians are dying. During these attacks, our president has always called on people not to follow what he described as criminal orders, because our president has created a very serious system for protecting human rights. You know, I have been a human rights defender all my life. I remember how throughout my career, many countries used to teach us what human rights were. But now we look at what is happening in those countries and ask, where are those human rights? We have managed to defend our own model of human rights protection, our human rights sovereignty, which was established by our president. And he cares about every single person.
I have to ask if a soldier has ever said, as you were preparing to send him back to Ukraine, a captured Ukrainian soldier, and they said, I don't want to go, I want to stay in Russia. Are there cases where they get to stay in Russia?
Of course, and there have been cases when these soldiers later wanted to join and fight on our side to defend Russia because they no longer wanted to fight there. Moreover, we currently have a program. If you do not want to fight, you can immediately surrender and move to our territory. There are many such cases, but independent journalists talk about them. They don't talk about them there. You know, besides you, there were other journalists in Starobelsk as well. When I picked up that bloodstained psychology notebook and showed it to one journalist, I asked, could this be military equipment? Could this be a military target? Could this be a military base? I saw her put on her glasses, and there were tears in her eyes that she was trying to hide. She did not want to listen to me. She asked me, but what about the children who are dying? And I answered, children should not die. We call for their protection, but unfortunately, every time there are provocations. Every time at UN events, we hear the Ukrainian representative say that it was an incident, that the data has not been verified, that they do not know. The second thing he says is that no journalists have seen the truth, even objective journalists. But there were 50 international journalists there from different countries. So according to this argument, all of them are supposedly not objective. Then representatives of Western countries say, aren't you ashamed? But the truth is, they are not ashamed. They are not ashamed that they turn a blind eye to this. Regarding Donbass, in 2014, I was a participant in the human rights group of the Petersburg Dialogue between Russia and Germany. I was in the Bundestag, where I spoke about human rights issues, presented information, and showed these photographs. I said, these are peaceful children. Please help us, human rights defenders and civil activists. Simply evacuate these children through a humanitarian corridor that Ukraine itself joined under international conventions.
Yeah.
But they turned a blind eye. They said, this is politics. This is politics. But how are these children politics?
Yes.
Where is the politics in this?
Children,
this is a policy of double standards.
Children are not soldiers. Children are not terrorists. Children are not political. They're just children. And all countries should leave children alone. And that's not Putin's law. That's not Trump's law. That's not your law. That's not my law. That's God's law. And that's the most important thing that we should do. It's great that you've taken us through this story to get a better understanding of the difficulties from a civilian, from a human standpoint of this war. But let's finish with Russia itself. Russia went through the Soviet era, ended that in the 90s. There's certainly some questions as to whether there were real human rights during the Soviet era. Then it went through the 90s where it was just ugly here. There was crime, there were gangs. It was a terrible time in Russia. I think there was a lack of human rights then too, maybe caused by societal needs. Today in Russia, it seems to me, people are generally content with their lives. They want more, of course. They complain about the government, of course. They think there may be some corruption, of course. But generally speaking, Russians seem to feel like the government is taking care of their basic needs. So let me ask you, as the High Commissioner of Human Rights in Russia, are the human rights of the Russian people being respected by Mr. Putin's government?
Absolutely, yes. Moreover, an entire ombudsman institution has been established. By the way, next year it will mark 30 years of its existence. It is an independent body whose activities are regulated by the first federal constitutional law. You can see the role of the Human Rights Commissioner and what the Commissioner does. They present reports to the State Duma and the Federation Council, informing lawmakers about the human rights situation in the country, and they work the appeals of citizens. Over the past year, the Commissioner's office received many thousands of appeals. These covered a wide range of issues, essentially every area related to human rights. When violations are identified, government bodies respond immediately and work to resolve them so that people's rights are ultimately protected. Moreover, after each case, we analyze why the situation occurred and propose legislative changes to prevent similar problems in the future.
What about when it doesn't happen? What if me and you and my wife and a couple of people here say, we're going to go out there right now and we're going to have a protest and we're going to hold signs and say, this war must end. And the police come and arrest us and say, you're not allowed to have that protest. Aren't they, in essence, taking away our human right by not allowing us to give our opinion? Does that happen? And if that happens, would you protect the rights of those people?
There are opportunities for citizens to exercise their political rights and express their opinions. For example, you can walk past the State Duma building where people stand with pickets protesting against something. They can stand there and nobody touches them. Moreover, State Duma deputies will come out to them and ask about their concerns. I myself was a deputy. If someone was standing there, for example, an elderly woman who had come from a region, I, as a deputy from the Chelyabinsk region, would approach her and speak with her so we could resolve her issue. It would be completely peaceful. Nobody would interfere. In fact, security personnel sometimes even come out and bring water to these people. All the stories are myths. Once I was abroad and someone said to me, oh, but how can that be? It must be dangerous in your country. You have the Chechen Republic. But the head of Chechnya invited international bloggers to come and see how people can walk around the city completely freely. People saw this for themselves. Myths and stories are made up about Russia. When I had the opportunity to speak with teachers from Donbass, from the Luhansk People's Republic, the Donetsk People's Republic, and the Kherson and Zaporozhye regions, they told me, we have never seen schools like the ones Vladimir Putin has built in our historical territories. We have never seen such high-quality facilities, infrastructure, or hospitals. They told us that they had been told Russia banned the study of foreign languages and that people are not allowed to speak differently or express themselves differently. They said they did not believe it. They were told made-up stories, just like those about bears walking around carrying bottles of vodka. These are the myths that are told about our country. In reality, we are a unique country that loves people and will protect the rights of every individual, regardless of age, gender, nationality, or religion. We respect different religions, and we have a very large number of laws and documents designed to protect the rights and feelings of believers. This receives special attention. I headed a committee dealing with religious affairs and regularly met with representatives of even the smallest regions and faith communities because we respect them. Our president, the government, and citizens all understand that human rights are extremely important. That is why the Human Rights Commissioner reports to the president on the state of human rights.
Yes.
These rights are protected in every region of the Russian Federation.
You do. I saw you with Mr. Putin just a couple of weeks ago. Yes.
Yes, and this exists in every region. We have 89 regions in the country, and there are regional human rights commissioners in each one. There are federal and regional ombudsmen, with 89 regional human rights commissioners working across the country. We are a human rights team that works directly on the ground, and every ombudsman is close to the problems faced by ordinary citizens. Several times a year, as the federal ombudsman, I bring together all regional commissioners, and we discuss issues related to protecting citizens' rights. Every individual case matters, because behind every story there is a human life and a personal fate that we must protect. And we will protect every single person. This is our mission, and our president created this system.
But when it comes to human rights in Russia, I think it's safe to say that you are the boss lady, and you do it very well. You protect the people of Russia, you protect their rights, and I think that's important. And it's a story that goes, unfortunately, too often untold. Is every human right respected at all times in this country? Obviously, not in this country and not in any country. Things happen. But generally speaking, as I have been able to see it as a foreigner walking around in Russia, there is a general sense that the people's sense of inalienable rights, as we call it in America, is in fact protected. And it has been delightful to have you be gracious enough to share so much of your wisdom and so much of what you've been doing in your job, in particular with this very difficult situation that we all hope will end soon between Russia and Ukraine. Thank you so much, Madam High Commissioner, for coming and joining us. You have been so gracious with your time. Thank you again. And let's stay in touch. This is an important thing that you do. You're doing God's work.
Thank you very much. Thank you for everything you do, because it is difficult not only to speak the truth, but also to be able to hear the truth. Thank you for making this possible.
That's nice. I appreciate that. And we do have, some millions of people who are watching this show every day. And, you know, we try and share with them this very story, this thing that we, you know, that we call trying to get to the truth, trying to get to different perspectives. And often the perspective that we share here in Moscow is different from the one that people expect to hear or expect to see. Even just seeing families behind me strolling through what is the Kremlin and the Mac Daddy part of Moscow, as I like to say, tends to surprise people. I think the High Commissioner is correct. People have a very different, as she says, legendary impression of what's actually going on in this city. So I think it's important to share the good, the bad, and ask the difficult questions at all time. And that's why we talk to Russian ministerial officials like Yana to bring us this kind of information. Thanks so much for being with us all this week. You know, you can find what we say and what we do. Much of this conversation that we just had is now going to be on YouTube and on X and on Spotify, as well as on BitChute and all of the social media sites. And there as well, sometimes it's seen by 10 million people alone. And many of you are in the United States, and you're in Canada, and you're in Australia, and you're in the UK, and you write to us all the time. Keep writing. Keep telling us what we're doing wrong or what we're doing right. If you disagree with something I say, if you disagree with something she says, let us know. I want to read it. I go through almost all of the comments. I like it. Good, bad, indifferent, it doesn't matter. And most of all, thank you so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll be looking for you again next time.